Hey everybody, this is Ben dropping you a quick note. Our editors have been working hard to get episodes finished to release on schedule with the reading of the week. Our hope is that listeners will have the chance to engage with the content and share meaningful ideas in their circles of family, friends, and church. In order to meet this goal, this episode has been released with minimal editing. We are looking for additional volunteers to join the team and help with editing, social media management, and content creation. If you are interested, please reach out to us on Facebook or email latterdaypeacestudies@gmail.com. You can also donate to the project, helping us cover the costs of things like website hosting and podcast platform fees. Donations can be made through PayPal by going to our website, latterdaypeacestudies.org, clicking Get Involved, and scrolling down to the donate box. Thanks so much to all who have helped out and donated over the years. We are sincerely grateful. Latter-day Peace Studies is produced by peace-loving members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Any views expressed herein are not to be taken as official positions of the Church or its authorities.
Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I'm Christopher Hurtado.
And I'm Ben Peterson.
Thank you for joining us as we discuss this week's reading of Come Follow Me as outlined by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our hope is that as we discuss the scriptures, we will come to a more perfect understanding through experiencing the atonement of Jesus Christ and find greater peace in our lives. Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I am your co-host, Christopher Hurtado. With me is my co-host, Ben Peterson. Ben, it is always a pleasure to do this with you. I usually say this at the end. I wanted to start off by saying it at the beginning. It really is. We get to, you know, we send messages back and forth while we're reading and studying all week. And then we talk for at least an hour before we record. And so the awesomeness has already begun before we even turn on the microphone. And now we get to turn on the microphone and the awesomeness continues for the next hour to hour and a half or so, hopefully an hour. And there is a lot to talk about this week, though. So one more thing before we get started. The Come Follow Me study group that used to meet, this is Latter-day Peace Studies Come Follow Me study group. It's an online study group. We meet by Zoom. I know a lot of us are tired of Zoom, and yet we get to get together to talk about the reading. And we used to do this Sunday mornings. It started during the lockdown phase of the past pandemic, and there was no church, and this is all there was, and a lot of us got together. And we lost some of the people, you know, as people went back to church, and the host changed. It was somebody else, and then it was Shiloh, and it was Eli, right? Eli Bowman, and then Shiloh Logan, and then me. And then we changed it with this year, where even I couldn't do it in the morning, into the afternoon. And this made a difference because now we're covering the week ahead reading. Instead of the week behind reading, we're discussing the reading for the week ahead, which means we talk about this week's reading the day before the podcast comes out. So if you want to get into this, you know, with us before the podcast comes out on Monday, come Sunday afternoon to the Come Follow Me study group. There's an invitation posted every Sunday right before it starts on Facebook in our group. What's that called again, Ben?
The Facebook group is Latter-day Nonviolence, Pacifism, and Peace Studies.
That's a mouthful.
And that's the group that you can join. It's kind of a mouthful, yeah. The page where we post other things like the memes and the podcast links, stuff like that, is Latter-day Peace Studies.
Cool. So one or the other or both, like, subscribe, join, comment, share, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thanks for joining us. Let's go into this week's reading.
So this week, Christopher, we are discussing Matthew chapter 14, Mark chapter 6, and John chapters 5 and 6. A little bit more reading this time, and we get some things out of John. We've got, you know, that bread of life sermon. We do get some similar stories between these chapters. There's discussions of John the Baptist's death. We get the feeding of the 5,000, which is one of just two miracles that we find in all four of the Gospels. The other one of those is Jesus walking on the water. So we're covering both of those miracles this week, the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water, which are the two miracles that are found and discussed or covered in all four of the Gospels. We also are going to talk about the healing at the Pool of Bethesda, and there's then some debates that Jesus has with the Pharisees, and then, as I mentioned before, the what we call the Bread of Life sermon that's focused mostly in John chapter 6.
All right. Well, let's go into the reading, starting with Matthew 14. You know, I like to start with Mark, but let's do this in the order the reading is assigned. Mark is the earlier gospel. I might mention the parallel passages when they occur, although I didn't necessarily think about John when I did that, you know, when I put together my notes for this. But, you know, this is one of those weeks where Matthew, Mark, and John are telling the same stories, and that gospel parallel document that we created really comes in handy. So if you haven't heard of that, or if you have heard of it and you haven't gotten it yet, reach out to us. All we need is your email. We are building an email list, and we'll give you access to that document. You'll be able to compare each story in the New Testament side by side in the four Gospels, or as many as it appears in, broken down by pericope, by actual story, not by chapter. Really an ideal way to study. I wish we could do it that way, but we're following the curriculum. So we'll go into Matthew 14. So the first thing I want to go into is Matthew 14, verses 3 through 4, which is parallel with Mark 6, 18. Will you read those verses, Ben?
For Herod had laid hold on John and bound him, and put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. For John said unto him, It is not lawful for thee to have her.
Yeah, so if you're wondering what's going on here, this goes back to Leviticus 18, 16 and 20, 21. Which originally probably refers to an adulterous relationship with a brother-in-law, but eventually, maybe by this period, right, it becomes something to do with forbidding a divorce from one brother and then marrying another. So it's one of those, you know, it's like, I remember reading in the LDS temple once from Moses, I think it was either 3 and 4 or 5 and 6, something like that, and they were on facing pages, and Adam is told not to eat from the fruit. And then on the next page, and this is why I noticed it, I was reading closely and they were side by side on facing pages. Eve is talking with the serpent and telling the serpent, we were told not even to touch the fruit. And you think, wait a minute, that's not what Adam said on the previous page. This is Eve is the first rabbi. She's doing midrash, right? So this is the idea of don't even get close to the devil's throat. Do you remember that talk, Ben?
Yeah, right.
Okay, so that's that. And then the next verse is, well, a couple of verses, Matthew 14, 6 through 11, also in Mark 6, 22. And the question here is, who is this girl who's dancing? She's supposed to be the daughter of Herod, but that doesn't seem, this is not a respectable thing for a Greek or even a Jewish man to just put his daughter on display to dance for everybody like a prostitute. It's really strange, right? I don't know what to make of it. So I just thought I'd point that out. And that brings us to the feeding of the 5,000. Well, 5,000? 5,000 men, right?
Sure. We have different accounts here that are going to say men besides women and children, right? So it's not necessarily clear.
Oh, let me comment on that, Ben, because actually the one chapter tells us men, and I'm not counting the women and children, right? And so it actually says in the Greek there, it's actually human beings, but not counting the women and children. But over in the other chapter, it says men. And it actually, the Greek actually says men. And this is how we know that the women and children aren't being counted. But in either case, we're looking at what? 2 times, 3 times as many people, probably maybe 15,000 people.
Yeah, I would say at least according to that statement, right? Besides women and children, you'd have to, I would say, at least multiply by 3, if not more.
So what do you do with that, Ben?
So in my mind, this incident seemed to always accompany some sort of teaching. But as I was reading through the text, I couldn't find any evidence that these people were being taught in a group. You know, this isn't like some Sermon on the Mount occasion here, where he's standing in the middle of 15,000 people and teaching them. That doesn't make sense. You can't amplify your voice in such a way. You'd have to have an amphitheater that's huge and the acoustics would have to be just right, right? So sure, you could have some supernatural miracle that makes this happen, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny because the text actually tells us that Jesus was actually trying to get away from these people. He goes in his boat to get away from them, but they, what does it say in the King James? They overtake him. It's a strange word for us nowadays, right? But the point is, what it means is they got there first. they went where he was going and got there first. So he says, he has compassion. He says, okay, I'll heal them while they're here. But then it becomes eventide and they're hungry.
Right. And so again, this occasion isn't so much a gathering where he's teaching. It's a gathering of a lot of people trying to get to him to be healed. And he's doing that. But again, it's not, he's not giving some discourse or sermon in this case. So I think the main idea going on with this story, right, where you have the boy that has loaves and fishes and they share them with everybody. I think one of the main ideas here is that Jesus is requiring for those that follow him all that they have. And maybe that's a little and maybe that's a lot. And I think the point here is that this is why it's so difficult for the rich to follow him. We get these other stories, right, of the rich man coming to him and Jesus says, give up everything you have and follow me. And if you're rich and you have a lot, it's a lot more difficult to give all that all up and follow Jesus. But if you're poor, right, there's not a whole lot to give up to follow Jesus. This seems to go along with the beatitude, blessed are the poor. Now, Luke, when we talked about this in Luke chapter 6, this is talking in a little more of an economic sense to somebody who is actually economically poor in terms of material goods. In Matthew, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit. So this is looking more in terms of their spiritual well-being or their state of mind. And we get another thing, another addition to this statement, blessed are the poor in spirit, in 3rd Nephi, the sermon at the temple, where he says, who come unto me, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They all are really expressing this concept that coming to Jesus means giving something up, whether it's material possessions or maybe your previous notions about how life is supposed to be or your beliefs and accepting what Jesus has. And those who have a lot of those things, who have a lot of ideas and material goods and so forth, may find it difficult to follow Jesus. And so here with the feeding of the 5,000, the idea here is that even if it's a little bit that this boy is giving up, it ends up, because he gives it to Jesus and follows Jesus, it ends up being able to feed everybody. Now, I'll have some more commentary on this when we get to this point in John, but that's kind of what stood out to me here about this idea.
Okay.
After this incident, Jesus goes up on the mountain to pray. So this happens quite a bit of him going off either into the wilderness or up on the mountain to pray. We've talked about this a lot as well. This is symbolic of going to a place that's closer to God, but it's also literal in the sense that this is a great way to sort of get away and find time for yourself, be away from people, pray, be with God, commune with God type of thing.
Yeah, to me, it's been kind of funny to, you know, reading closely and seeing Jesus sort of running away from people. You know, people are coming, better get out of here. Or, you know, he does, you know, again, with the people that came in the case of the feeding of the 5,000, as we call it, when we're really only talking about the men when we say 5,000. But the idea is he's trying to get away from them and they show up and he does have compassion when they show up, but he wants to get alone with his disciples so he can teach them sometimes. Other times he wants to be completely alone so he can tank up, as I like to put it, right? He comes back with power when he goes off in the wilderness to be alone with God.
Yeah. So then we have this moment where the disciples go in the boat, right? And then Jesus comes later and he's walking on the water. Now, in the account of Matthew, we get this additional little story within the story where Peter calls to Jesus, recognizes that it's Jesus, and asks Jesus to command him to come to him on the water. I thought this was just this concept here was a little strange, you know, that Peter is asking Jesus to command him to do something. And this is, at least at a certain level, a demonstration of trust, right? He trusts that if Jesus commands it, that it then will be possible. And so that seems to be the driving power here, is Jesus's command. It's like when he commands someone to be clean or commands them to be healed. That's kind of what Peter is getting after here. He wants Jesus to command him to do something because he knows that Jesus's command is where the power is. So if Jesus commands him to do it, then Peter trusts that there's the faith and he can get out and walk towards Jesus. Then we have obviously the whole scenario where Peter kind of sees the waves and starts losing his confidence somewhat. And I've heard lots of interesting interpretations on that. But the thing that stood out to me this time was just the fact that Peter is asking to be commanded, and a little bit strange scenario there.
Yeah. You know, I'll probably have more to say about the feeding of the 5,000, as we call it, later on too, as we're covering this story more than once. But thinking about Matthew 14:19, compare Mark 6:40, there's this whole scene is depicted as this outdoor feast. And it's interesting because it has all of the trappings, let's say, of an indoor social gathering, right? So you normally have these drinking parties, and you know, you have the two by two, right, side by side, all these things going on, and the men are reclining, it says, and the women, they actually do the same thing, even if it's not mentioned, right? That's part of the scene. So it's kind of an interesting scene, this whole, what'd you call it, Ben, in pre-show discussion, a big picnic?
Yeah, right? This is a big picnic.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. And so we do get again that it's 5,000 grown men had eaten in Matthew 13:21, besides women and children, right? In 14:31, when Peter's walking on the water, you get in Rudin's translation, I thought I'd share because it just struck me. Sometimes, you know, because she's putting it in with no theological commitment that I can perceive, even the NRSV scholars, when they have gotten together to work on their translation, they come from different theological backgrounds and try to be neutral in their translation without any theology winning out over any other theology. But with Rudin, it's like she has no theological commitment at all. And so you get sort of this plain language. You also get things like, you know, Jesus comes down from the sky instead of the heavens. And heavens is just the sky, right? Except that it becomes 1 degree, how did you call it, Ben? One step removed from the skies, and it becomes something else, right?
Yeah, it's theologically loaded. And so then the concept is again, one layer removed sort of metaphorically from the literal sky. You get this, oh, it's not literal sky, it's a metaphorical sky, a different plane of existence, right? Heavens. But it's not up there really, it's up there.
Right, there you go. So will you read Matthew 14:31 from KJV?
And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?
So there we have thee of little faith, right? Wherefore didst thou doubt? So you have this doubting Thomas type situation. He has little faith. We've talked about this before, how the word translated faith is pistis, right? It means trust. And so here's Rudin. You with hardly any trust, why did you waver? It just has a different feel, doesn't it, Ben?
One of the main reasons I like her translations is because she, as much as she can, she gives us a different perspective, like a different angle on the lexical range of the words, right? So that whenever it's possible to stay true to the translation, but use a different word, she does, so that you get that new angle, new understanding of what the text is.
Right. And by different word, Ben, you mean different from the one we're used to in the King James Version. Or, you know, if somebody
out
there...
most other translations.
Yeah. Right. If somebody out there is listening in Spanish even, you know, they get Reina Valera and it says whatever, and they're used to looking at the King James in English. We each have our translation that we're used to reading. And one of the first things you can do, one of the easiest things you can do because you don't have to learn Greek to do this, is just read another translation and understand that they're probably both accurate, right? You spoke of lexical range, Ben. This means, for the listener who doesn't know the terms, right, it just means each word can have more than one translation. It can be anywhere from this to this, and that's what we mean by lexical range.
Yeah, like it's, I've said sphere of meaning before.
That's right. That's another way to put it. I'm really going to miss Rudin when we run out of her translation, which is only the four Gospels. So here we go with Mark 6. So the first thing I noticed in Mark 6 is in verses 1 through 3, that the people are surprised at what Jesus is doing and saying, and even who he is. What manner of man is this, is the kind of thing we get, right? Now, sometimes it's because he's doing things that, as we read them, sound supernatural. But the thing that Rudin points out in one of her footnotes I wanted to share is just that we don't really know what kind of man is expected to teach in a synagogue, or as she says, to perform other religious functions in an outlying community, right? So it isn't clear, really, why the people are so surprised, right? We don't know. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be surprised. We have no idea why.
Yeah, we don't have all the context.
Yeah, so I just want to point out, again, just like Rudin is doing, we want to awaken in you the idea that maybe you don't know exactly what's going on in these texts, right? We're so used to hearing these stories and hearing them in the same translation that we can get this false sense of security that we know what's going on. And so what I've experienced doing this study and to prepare for this podcast is, you know, I've got to take a critical thinking approach and not know what's going on and see what the text says, right? That's my job. What does this text say? So putting aside my theology, I can talk about it with or without the theology. I'm just setting it aside so I can just look at the text, right?
Yeah, trying to make as few assumptions as possible.
Right. So the other thing is, he gets called the son of Maria, is it? It depends on the gospel author. Sometimes Mary is called Mariam, sometimes she's Maria. But why not say the son of Joseph or the son of the carpenter? Even if he were dead, it's unusual. It's almost, you know, how about son of the builder, right? I say carpenter. He's a tecton, so some kind of builder. And so there are textual variants of these verses. And it's just interesting to see, why would they not say, you know, the son of Joseph? We get that elsewhere, right? I know the whole son of God idea, right? Again, that's a king, right? And he's going to be Shahanshah, the king of kings, right? Do you have any thoughts about that, Ben? Anything to add?
Well, I think it's a good question to ask because they're referencing his mother and then his brothers and sisters, and they say nothing about his father. Like, theologically, as you're reading the gospel, you're like, well, we know that he's the son of God, right? But what we're getting is a quote from the people who don't believe that he's the son of God. And so why don't they reference his father, Joseph?
Exactly.
Not clear. This could be simply the way that the author is choosing to portray what the people are saying, not necessarily a quote unquote, you know, a literal quote of them. Rather just, you know, inserting their own views about how his family situation would be. We don't know exactly how the people would have referenced him. If they referenced him this way, then there had to be some strange social reason why they don't mention Joseph.
One that isn't readily apparent, right? So yeah. We are in Mark. Again, this is the earliest gospel, but even Mark, the author of this gospel, isn't someone who knew Jesus in life. This is years later. Mm-hmm. And we're not quoting anybody verbatim. Mark told us at the beginning of his gospel that he was it Mark or Luke who says, I'm getting together the best stories I can and trying to put them in some kind
of
order.
That's Luke. But Mark is essentially doing the same thing.
Exactly. They each had to do the same thing. They have all these versions. And by the way, it's interesting because the newer the gospel, right, the later the gospel, the more details, right? So you can imagine all these different stories, and as the stories get passed along, they get embellished, and so the later versions have more details. It's interesting. And then, of course, John being the latest, now you're into, and we'll, you know, be going into John again this week. There's another thing. I had a funny thing to say. I think it's funny. It's not meant to be irreverent. I think I said it in front of my in-laws, and my father-in-law took it as an irreverent comment. My mother-in-law understood where I was coming from. I said, if your seriously studying these texts, and you read that this week you have to read from John, and you don't feel a sense of dread, or, you know, you don't feel, you know what I mean? When I say dread, I mean, oh my gosh, I have to read from John. You know, I don't know if I can, I don't understand John, right? So it's this really theological text.
Intimidation, maybe.
Intimidation. Yeah, exactly. If you don't get some kind of sense of dread, of intimidation, I question how closely you're reading, put it that way. At least that's my experience. So the next thing in Mark, you know, 6 is in verse 4. The usual translation says something like without honor, right? What does the King James read?
But Jesus said unto them, a prophet is not without honor, but in his own country, and among his own kin, and in his own house.
So there it is, right? And by the way, all those he's and masculines, they're not necessarily in the text. I think I went over this before I looked into it. And a prophet is without honor in their own country or hometown or whatever. We all know how that goes. So without honor, though, is translating atimos, which isn't really just a lack of honor. It's usually dishonor, right? So it's much stronger, right? He's dishonored. And so perhaps that shouldn't be surprising considering the context that, you know, this comes out of, the Old Testament context, where those prophets really were treated with dishonor in their own communities. And they ended up having to flee and find refuge, and are able to find refuge elsewhere, right? Somewhere where they're not from. I thought that was interesting.
So Rudin says something like, a prophet is dishonored in his own country?
Yeah, she actually says, but Jesus said to them, a prophet isn't treated dishonorably except in his hometown and among his own relatives and in his own house. And she does have masculine pronouns there.
Okay, so it's not the lack of honor, it's the presence of dishonor. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, following up on this, because of this situation, we get this in verse 5, he could do no deed of power there, right? That's sort of an NRSV translation. You know, the idea here is people don't believe in him, or rather they don't trust him. They won't do what he commands. Earlier with Peter, we talked about how Peter wanted to be commanded to walk on the water. When Jesus heals people, he commands them to be clean or to be healed. So to me, there might be some theological ambiguity here, Christopher. Like, so is Jesus able to heal people against their will or not? So I think, again, we have a theological question here. What is Jesus able to do? Because it uses the word can here, can do no.
Right.
This sort of echoes what we get in the Book of Mormon in Ether 12, verse 12. It says, if there is no faith, God can do no miracles among them. So yeah, the question is God really not able to do miracles? Like, he doesn't have that ability if people don't have faith?
Yeah, let me give you another translation again, Rudin. And in that place, he couldn't perform any powerful act, except that he placed his hands on a few sick people and healed them. So does that mean he doesn't have this power except for in the case of a few people, or those few people were willing to listen when he commands them to be well? Whereas the others say, again, what we read in the verse before, which is something like, who's this guy? Why should we listen to him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's sort of a disconnect here, though. You know, like, one question is, what is the text saying, right? What is the text implying about what Jesus can do? And then we have this other question, what do we believe about what Jesus can do, what the power of God can do? One of the ways that I've approached this idea or this concept of miracles in our life is more about what our perception is. When we don't trust God, or our eyes aren't open to seeing him in the world around us, in nature, in other people, in ourselves, I think this does something to blind us in a way to the miracles that are happening all the time around us. We're not seeing them. And so it's not a matter of them not happening. It's a matter of us not perceiving them.
Yeah, you know, I'm reminded of something I recently read. I think it was William James who said that belief and attention are the same thing. So where we're putting our attention is, that's our belief. And whoever holds our attention, then they have some kind of power over us in some sense, right? And that can be the church, that can be the Lord, right? Whatever your belief is, wherever your attention is, the two being one and the same, as I believe as William James put it. Isn't that interesting?
That is. That for me, that goes back to Peter on the water, right? You know, where was his attention? Was it on Jesus? Was it on the water and the waves and the wind, right?
Right. And the answer is it was on Jesus when it was on Jesus, and it was on the water when it was on the water, right? And that's right. The problem. Yeah, very yeah. Good. Yeah, good point. So the next comment I have is from Mark 6, 8 through 9. The whole idea of how the people that Jesus is sending out two by two to preach are supposed to go. And it looks a lot like the same rules that the Essenes follow. This is the ascetic sect that's living out at Qumran, right, in the desert. They're part of the purity culture people, right? I mean, they're different groups, right? They're the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and then the Essenes. And the Essenes are the ones who said, okay, we're just going to completely separate from society and be pure in that way. And the Pharisees and Sadducees we deal with more often. They're supposed to depend wholly on the people they're around. And in the case of the Essenes, it would be the people that belong to their own sect. In the case of Jesus's disciples that he's sending out as apostles, right, as messengers, they're supposed to be completely dependent on the people they're staying with, and they don't even carry a stick. So they look a lot like cynics too in the Greek tradition. You know, they just have one article of clothing, not two. The cynics at least had a walking stick. These guys aren't supposed to have a walking stick, which, by the way, is not an ordinary walking stick. This is supposed to defend them from, say, a dog attack or something. And if you haven't been attacked by a dog, I have. And I wish I had had a stick at the time.
Yeah, they go further than the cynics. Yeah. With no purse or script.
Exactly. So they wouldn't want to look like they could be violent, right? They don't even have... It's because that staff, that stick can be a defensive weapon, but it can also be offensive. So he says, you don't even carry a walking stick. I thought that was interesting. And in Mark 6, 12 through 13, in Rudin's translation, we have that the students went out and announced that people should change their purpose. This is probably something like repent, right? Change their purpose. And they expelled many demons, and they rubbed olive oil on many sick people and healed them. So we have in King James that they were anointed with oil. I thought it was interesting that Rudin said olive oil, but I looked at the Greek, and sure enough, the word that's translated oil is really olive oil. And so she points out that it's commonly used at the time for removing dirt from the skin. And so it's probably going to be really good for soothing wounds and sores and rashes, she says. This reminded me of how it is around our place, where we don't have, doctors any more than they did. We don't go to the doctor. We just have my wife to rub essential oils on us. It's the same idea, right? In Mark 6:28, we have this girl we mentioned earlier who's dancing, that's supposed to be the daughter of Herod, dancing before his guests. And she has a wish. Depending on which gospel you're reading, you can really clearly see that it's her mother's idea, or she's at least consulting with her mother. But the point is, she wants the head of John the Baptist on a platter. This is where we get the expression, I'll have your head on a platter, right?
Yeah.
And so it says in Mark 6:28 in Rudin's translation, and he brought his head on a platter and gave it to the little girl. And that just got my attention in that moment, because I said, wait a minute, little girl, that's not what we got earlier. And then again, I went to the Greek, and sure enough, this is a little girl. So it becomes even stranger at that point, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is meant to highlight the depravity of, of the king?
You know what? That's probably a good reading, Ben. You know, the idea that the king would do something so shameful, and I mean, that this is a little girl and that she's dancing before his guests, it really doesn't make sense any other way. It's the kind of thing we see like in Suetonius in the Lives of the 12 Caesars. I'm sure the 12 Caesars did some bad things, but I'm not sure they did all the things that Suetonius says they did. You see what I mean?
Right.
So yeah, that's probably a good reading. That makes sense. In Mark 6:31 through 32, King James gives us a desert place. And I think this is the place where we're going to have the not sermon, right? The feeding of the 5,000. And so it's not a desert though, right? I just think with King James, you could misunderstand, right? So it's a solitary place. It's a solitary place. And that's actually what we get from the Joseph Smith translation. I don't know if you picked up on that, Ben. I went to the Greek, and then I found that the Joseph Smith translation agreed. I don't think that's where Joseph Smith gets his ideas. I don't think he read Greek, but he does have the right answer on this one, the solitary place.
Yeah, when we say desert, you know, the implication is, you know, no water, no plants, nothing's growing, stuff like that, right? Right. But we mean deserted, like, as in there's nobody that lives around there, right? This is wilderness or rural, right? So there's not any shops around, there's not any towns or cities anywhere close to be able to get any supplies or food, right? This is out in the country.
Yeah. So that's the idea. There's no farms, there's no people living there. And that's going to be the issue when it becomes time to eat, right? Because in one of the stories we get, we'll tell them to go buy some food, you know, go back to where there are farms or mm-hmm. dwellings and buy some food. And then Jesus says, well, you feed them. Well, what are we supposed to feed them? And by the way, are we supposed to spend that much money to feed all these people? No. What do you have, right? And we'll go into that more later.
Yeah.
So in Mark 6:33, the King James reads, and the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran afoot thither out of all cities, and outwent them, and came together unto him. So this is, again, this is the verb I couldn't remember earlier. It's just strange, right? We don't talk like this anymore. The people, Jesus is trying to get away, and the people outwent him, well, them, him and his apostles, right? His disciples, that is. And they actually get there first, and so Rudin has it, but many people saw them leaving and recognized them, so they ran on foot from all the towns to assemble there and arrived before those on the boat did. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this verse is because of the Joseph Smith translation, because I was looking at it, right, I went to Adam Clark, where a lot of those translations come from, and I said, well, let me see what it says there, and it turns out this verse, the people that appear here, or the multitudes is really what we're dealing with, is they're not in many of the manuscripts. Even though it seems like because there's all these people going to be there to be fed later, if we read the story literally, Ben, and we're going to have more to say about that, right? If we read it as some kind of supernatural miracle, which isn't to say it's not a miracle, but only if we read it as a supernatural miracle, then we need to have all these people there. We don't have to have 5 or 15,000 people otherwise, right? So whoever is inserting the people here in verse 33, it's because they're these people later. Later they're mentioned. Here they're not necessarily mentioned. So I thought that was interesting. In fact, this is what Clark says. Amidst the abundance of various readings, one can scarcely tell what its original state was. Yeah, and he says earlier, there's scarcely a verse in the whole New Testament that has suffered so much from transcribers as this verse. And so again, the issue here for the when it comes time to buy food, moving on to Mark 6:37, is we're talking about a laborer's wages for 200 days. On a single meal for a bunch of strangers that we were actually trying to get away from, right? That's the question of the disciples. You want us to do that?
Yeah.
So now we come to verse 48 of chapter 6 of Mark. This is really interesting. Something I hadn't noticed before, Ben.
I hadn't either. I did notice when I read this time, but I didn't decide to ask a question about it. Then you asked the question. You're like, yeah, I actually did have that question too. It's kind of weird.
Right. What does it say in King James?
And he saw them toiling and rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh unto them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them.
And that's all it says, right? That it would have passed by them. So I don't think I even noticed that when I've read this before, right? And if I did notice it, I don't think I got what Rudin made me see. She says, and he intended to pass by them. I said, wait, he intended to pass
intended.
By them? And there's the would, right? The would comes from will. It is my will, right? This is what I choose to do. I'm choosing he would pass by them, right?
When I read the King James, I see that and would have passed by them. It doesn't have to mean intention, right? It could mean that it was going to happen just naturally, right? Like he's walking and as he's walking, you know, he would have passed by them except that they called to him, but it doesn't have to imply intention.
Exactly.
So I thought it's interesting that Rudin says, no, intention is here.
And so I looked at the Greek and I can back up Rudin, ethelen parelthen, which is he was wishing to pass by.
Yeah, but why?
And so it's actually he was wishing to pass by. And so that's the thing. I don't know why. It's interesting. And in one of the versions of the story, as if I remember correctly from John, right? There is no anybody calling out to them. He actually walks past them as intended to the other shore. So he's intending to pass them by. They see him and they think he's a ghost.
They freak out.
That's a good way to put it. Here's how Rudin has it. And they screamed since they all saw him and were horrified. Now, I think she goes too far with horrified. I looked at the Greek. I don't think that's justified. I see why she did it, because they screamed. If you read King James, they cried out. And you think, hey, Jesus. Right? Yeah. No, they screamed. Because what did you say when I read you this? Like little girls. That's exactly, they
screamed like a little girl. Yeah.
That's exactly what I thought when I read this. And they screamed like little girls because they thought he was a ghost, right?
Yeah. So that's Mark chapter 6. We'll go to John chapter 5 now. The first thing that happens here in John chapter 5 is this pool of Bethesda. I discovered in some of the commentary that there actually has been a pool that resembles what is talked about in this story that has been excavated in Jerusalem. So it could be that there's some archaeological evidence that backs up some of the details of this story in terms of this pool. I thought that was kind of interesting. In the King James Version, verse 4 says this something about an angel, right, coming down and troubling the water and then person going on. It turns out that this statement about what an angel does with the water and people getting in and being healed, that doesn't exist in all of the texts, the textual authorities of the time. And so at least the NRSV doesn't include that in the actual text. It's just in a footnote you get this statement. So I've always thought it kind of a strange thing, you know, to have in the New Testament this statement about an angel coming down and stirring up water and people getting in it and being healed. And you think, well, if an angel is doing it, then just let the angel do it, Jesus. Why do you need to do it, right? But I'm not sure exactly where the idea comes from. Like I said, it exists in some of the texts and in others, it's not there.
Yeah, and Rudin leaves it out. She actually goes from verse 3 straight to verse 5, and then it's mentioned in a footnote that there's an explanation of how this miracle of the people getting in the water and being healed works in the excised verse 4.
Yeah, so it's very possible verse 4 is a later addition that wasn't in the earliest text of Mark.
And by the way, Ben, it's not only not in Rudin and in the NRSV, it's not in most, if not all, modern Bibles, right? It's strange to me that it's in our standard works. I guess we're just using the original KJV. I don't know. But it's not in most, if not all, modern Bibles.
Gotcha. So as the story goes, there's the man there that can't get up and get into the water to get healed. So Jesus comes along and he heals him. And then later in the story, he meets up with this man and tells him, don't sin so that nothing worse happens to you. So the idea of the time, there was a prevalent idea of the time that illness was potentially a punishment for sin or a result of sin of the person. And so Jesus seems to, in many cases, be dispelling this idea, except here, there might be an implication that he is threatening this person with more illness or something worse than what he had if he sins, right? As if what he had was the cause of sin. But I think in the context of the book of John, the focus is on spiritual harm of things. And so for me, this statement, something worse, is not threatening like a physical malady, but it's warning of a spiritual one, which would be worse than what the man had already been experiencing. And it says that he had that for 38 years, right? So Jesus is telling him, hey, you know how bad this physical thing was that you experienced? Sin does something worse to you. So sin is the lesson, right? Or the avoidance of sin or repentance is the lesson from the healing that happens.
I like that reading. It's better than, because here's the thing, it's really an ambiguous verse in some ways, right? Rhetorically speaking. You know, if you look at other Greek and Roman literature from the time, Rudin points out, these words, the way this is written, are insulting and they threaten a beating. So that kind of goes along with the reading that I think that you're actually speaking against, right? The one that says, oh, you were sick because of sin. You had this malady because of sin. And so now you're healed. Don't sin anymore or you'll get, you know, an even worse malady.
Right.
I like the spiritual reading of it.
You could read it that way, but there's...
Sure.
You know, it doesn't say that.
It really doesn't. That's the point. It's somewhat ambiguous, and that's why I like your reading. I don't think... Because it implies that Jesus believes... If we read it the way that I said, right, it implies that Jesus himself believes that the malady was the result of sin. This is a very... You know, this is the kind of view that Jesus is actually... speaking out against, right?
Right.
So your reading is more in line with Jesus's teachings.
Especially in the book of John, right?
Especially
like it fits the overall theological feel of the book of John. You know, Jesus came to save men's lives, not to destroy them, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, right? That's the whole idea here. And so if Jesus in this moment were saying something like, hey, you know, your sin caused this, don't sin anymore, or it'll get worse, right? Then it would seem to be contrary to the overall ideas going on in the book of John. So verses 17 through 20 are some more theological points made by Jesus. And some of them are a little strange, difficult to parse what he's actually saying. These read almost like creeds to me in some way, and I'm not sure exactly what he's getting at. Certainly we have commentary by from our doctrine, or, you know, even Joseph Smith had some things to say about this. But Jesus says he does what he sees the Father do. And it's kind of like, okay, what or how is Jesus seeing the Father do anything? Right? He has these moments where he goes up in the mountain and he's praying, communing with God. What is going on? Right? What is God doing in the very moment that Jesus is emulating? I know we have these interesting statements from the King Follett discourse where Joseph Smith seems to be saying, like, he's referencing some mortal life that God the Father had at some point, and so Jesus is emulating that. Or in any case, Jesus seems to be saying that he's doing exactly what God the Father would be doing if he were here. And so this is all in the context of this healing on the Sabbath, right? So the Sabbath is made for man, Jesus says, but my Father is still working on the Sabbath. God is still working on the Sabbath to save people. And so that's what I'm doing too.
Yeah. You know, backing up to the reading that comes out of the King Follett sermon, Joseph Smith's King Follett sermon or King Follett discourse.
Discourse, yeah.
It's called by both names. You know, I think it's interesting because what it does, if you just ignore the past part of it, the past part about it is that, you know, as they say in philosophy, it's turtles all the way down. In this case, it's God's all the way down. Mm-hmm. Right. And so whatever Jesus is doing, his Father actually did before. And so then it brings into question, really, what is the meaning of a universal atonement, right? Something like that. But what I like to do is go in the other direction with it and remind myself that we are called to be saviors on Mount Zion. When Jesus says, come follow me, that means we take up our cross, right? So I think that's the more useful way to look at it. The other direction is just philosophical, right? I mean, if you're into philosophical theology, awesome. We can talk. But I think, you know, for us, for it to be meaningful for us, the point is that just as he's following his Father, we follow him.
Right. Yeah, that's the imperative there. Sure. So verse 25, there's the statement, the hour is coming and is now here. He says this a few times, at least, throughout the book of John. To me, this is referencing what we've called the eternal now, right? And it's something like, soon you will experience this, but if you were ready, you could be experiencing it right now, right? This isn't some future event. It's something about you changing your perception of reality itself to live in it right now. What will change is not external to you. It's your preparedness and your perception of reality that's going to change.
That's so cool, Ben. I think that's it, right? That's the teaching. It's not just, you know, when the kingdom of heaven is at hand, meaning, remember, metanoia is to change your mind. We say repent, right? But to change your mind, if you could just notice it, right? It's because it says, right? I mean, it's in the Gospel of Thomas. I think it's in the canonical Gospels, isn't it, Ben, that the kingdom of God is... Well, it's, we have it that it's within you, right? And it's more
or among you as
or
well.
Among like, you, right? Yeah. In the Gospel of Thomas, you get that it's already here. You just can't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it becomes even clearer. And remember, that's an early gospel. And if it's not canonical, it's one of the sources for the canonical gospels. A lot of the sayings that we find in the Gospel of Thomas are in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
You know, Christopher, you mentioned metanoia, which we typically have translated as repentance, right? Or change of mind, literally, is what that is. But Rudin translated it earlier, if I'm right, as change of purpose. They're changing their purpose.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah, I hadn't thought of that way of formulating it before, too. I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. Changing your purpose. What are you driving towards? What are you aiming at, so to speak, right?
What are you up to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in verse 27, Jesus says that his authority, he bases it on this phrase, the Son of Man, you know, as Son of Man. Now, this seems to have dual meanings throughout the gospel, or at least two possible meanings, not necessarily always dual. It doesn't necessarily always mean two things. It may mean one or the other. And the two things typically that this can mean are, one, it's an eschatological term, meaning it's talking about the end times as referred to by Daniel and Ezekiel, who use this term Son of Man. And it's visions that they have of this future Son of Man that's going to come in some sort of end time and perform something, right? This is thinking in the future. The other sense in which Son of Man is used by Jesus, and sometimes ambiguously, is just to refer to himself as a mortal being. And in this verse, that seems to be the meaning that makes the most sense. So Son of Man can mean those different things, but in here, he's referring to his mortality more than anything. So Jesus is saying he has authority, or part of his authority is based on the fact that he is experiencing mortality and he understands what it means to be human. And so therefore, he's able to be a righteous judge, or able to execute judgment in the right way.
Yeah, there's that non-hierarchical meaning of authority again, right? One that's experience-based, not hierarchy-based. Yeah. You know, another thing is, I always like to remind the listener, anytime the Son of Man or the Son of God comes up, is that the Son of God is an earthly title and the Son of Man is a divine one. And I think we get that backwards sometimes. The Son of God is anyone who's a king on earth, whereas the Son of Man, at least here in the Gospel of John, as you pointed out, just has one of these more spiritual meanings to it, coming from Daniel. Right. And then there's just, you know, as Rudin has it here, as you pointed out, Son of Mankind, right? This is just a man cub we're talking about, right?
I'm human. I'm a human being. I'm only human, you know, type of thing. I'm like you. I'm experiencing mortality. And so I understand you.
And that's the thing, right? That's the experience, the authority, excuse me. That's the authority that gives, that comes from experience, right? I'm reminded of, is it Erasmus? I am human, nothing human is alien to me. It's either, it may be Terence, actually. I think it was Terence. I'm human. Nothing human is alien to me, right? If you're human, you know what it is to be human.
This reminded me of a quote from C.S. Lewis, because it kind of goes along with the idea that, okay, Jesus, yes, theologically, we conceptualize of him as the perfect man, you know, didn't sin and everything. So how is it that he can relate to us in any way? And I like, at least in one aspect, and this doesn't cover all of the ways of looking at this, but at least in one aspect, the way that C.S. Lewis puts this, he says, "No man knows how bad he is till he has tried very hard to be good. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside us until we try to fight it. And Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means, the only complete realist."
Wow. Your quotes are more orthodox than mine, Ben. C.S. Lewis is the most quoted non-Mormon in Mormon circles, right? Whereas I'm quoting Terence, the humanist.
So I think my only comment on that statement, he does say something about fighting the evil impulse. I think I would probably critique that a little bit and say that the way to deal with these things isn't to fight them, but to integrate them, like we talk about shadow, to understand where they come from. And, you know, when Jesus says, don't resist evil or evildoers, the idea here is that we understand the source of these things and we can deal with it at that level rather than just always trying to resist the impulse within us. Where does that come from? How can we understand where it comes from and deal with the source of that rather than just the inclination, right?
Yeah. And for the listener who's not familiar with shadow work, on our sister podcast, Latter-day Contemplation, Riley and I have had at least one discussion on this. There's an episode called The Shadow.
Yeah.
And that particular episode was with frequent guest Morgan Aldous. That's a good place to start. It's something that comes up here and there in episodes, but especially that conversation with Morgan on the shadow. You know, in verse 31, Ben, we get this idea, again, that we've mentioned before. In John, you always have these discourses from Jesus that we don't see in the other Gospels. And some of them are long discourses, self-referential long discourses, where he tells us who he is and what he is and how we should believe in him. And we get in this case some kind of witness of his identity. And it's along those lines, right? That's the kind of thing that you see in John.
So verse 39, I've heard this verse discussed quite a bit. And we've talked about these concepts of it. I'm just going to go ahead and read verse 39. He says, "Search the scriptures, for in them ye think ye have eternal life, and they are they which testify of me." Now, I don't know that the King James is the best translation of this, right? Obviously, you know, we are looking at other translations all the time. But what I mean by that is, I don't know that the King James really gives us a sense of what's going on here. It's difficult for us to parse the wording again with our modern language of this. And so if we can go to some other translations, we might be able to pick this verse apart a little better.
Right. We can look at Rudin. So King James, you know, it's a good translation of the best manuscripts they had. They just weren't really good manuscripts, right? There's that. And then there's the other thing you've suggested or hinted at, which is that we don't talk like that, right? So it's sometimes hard to understand. Let's look at Rudin. "You search the writings because you think you possess in them life for all time. But it's these that testify on my behalf. But you don't want to come to me to have life."
Yeah.
Can I give my interpretation? Because the thing that came to my mind, Ben, immediately when I said, okay, you're searching the scriptures because you think you have life in them, but you don't want to come to me to have life. I got a sense of knowledge without action. And I was reminded of 2 Timothy 3:7, always learning, but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, there's that idea again of just, you're just looking at the scriptures, and you're not actually understanding them. You're not acting on them. Maybe they're two separate things, right? You're not understanding them, not acting on them. And maybe it's that you need to act on them to really come to a knowledge of them. Again, that kind of experiential knowledge.
Follow me.
Right.
Yeah. You know, we've used this metaphor a lot, and I forget who says this, but they talk about the finger pointing at the moon, right? And so the scriptures are pointing to something. And here Jesus is saying, the scriptures are pointing to me, and you're very, very much interested in this hand and its pointer finger and how the hand is positioned and all the intricacies of the hand, right? You're so focused on this hand. And Jesus is saying, but you're not even considering what it's pointing at, right? The scriptures are testifying me. You think that your life is in the scriptures themselves, but actually where it is what they're pointing to. And you need to move beyond that. We've said before, Christopher, I think you gave me this phrase. The scripture is the penultimate word of God. So the scriptures are, in a sense, less important for what they say than what they make us think or what they lead us to think. So the ultimate word of God is the revelation that we receive as we pursue an understanding and we put the teachings of Jesus into practice in our life. So John says Jesus is the word, right, logos, because he's the aesthetic argument. He's the thing we can see, the living, breathing enactment and fulfillment, as we talked about, putting into practice these words, the law that we read about. But that's actually how to do it. That's what it looks like in real life if a person does it. So it's not a rhetorical or logical argument with words written out, sentences, but it's a aesthetic argument, an aesthetic logos that we actually see in life, see played out in life.
Behold the man, as it were. You know, here's another image for the listener. If we're not doing it the right way, then what we're actually doing is not that different from a cat chasing the laser pointer dot, right?
There you go.
The focus is on the dot, not what it's pointing at. That brings us to John 6, Ben.
Yeah, John chapter 6. So we're going to revisit the story here of the feeding of the 5,000, because when I was reading this in John 6, after reading it a couple times in Matthew and Mark, I started thinking about, like, okay, what is actually going on here? Like, what is the author intending? But then, like, what is, if I were there, what is actually happening here? So right. Obviously, I think the story by the authors is meant to convey the miraculous power that Jesus has. But I wonder if the miracle, the actual miracle, were less supernatural than we imagine.
So let's bring back the context of the guesstimated, shall I say, 15,000 people, right? 5,000 men plus women and children.
Yeah, right. And we're talking about 5 loaves of bread and 2 fishes. Yeah.
Right.
And those 5 loaves of bread aren't huge, you know, 6-foot loaves. And the fishes aren't 2 whales, right? You know, this right. is what we're talking about here.
And where do they come from?
Yeah, they come from one person that has them to share, right? And offers them to share.
Yes, indeed, offers them.
So here's, I think, where the spark of an idea of what's going on here came to me. I would say, while we definitely could ascribe a supernatural miracle going on here, and that certainly could have been the intention of the author, and I'm not discounting that possibility where the bread is actually multiplied in and of itself.
It could be supernatural, and it could be that the bread and the fish were multiplied. And if that were the case, so what? What does that have to do with me?
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. It's kind of like, okay, great, Jesus did a miracle. It's just another miracle that he did. And it, what is it, but what does that call to us to do? There doesn't seem to be much that it calls us to do, right? And that's, I guess that's part of where I was digging too. I'm like, what is this story asking me to do? And it doesn't, if it was just some supernatural multiplication, it doesn't seem to really be doing a lot of that.
No, it's just, you know, look at Jesus. He's great.
Yeah.
Believe in him. Again, this is different from the idea of trusting and following him, right?
Yeah, actually following him because we trust him. So if it went something like this, where the boy shares his food, Jesus says the text says Jesus looks up to heaven and blesses it and then starts breaking it and distributing it among the people. What if this process of the generosity of the boy and what Jesus does something like inspire the people that are there to start sharing the food they had brought with everybody else that they had been keeping back for themselves for maybe the trip back or maybe another time or they thought was just for them. So
or to have, what or if to the be really full rather than just satisfied or whatever, right?
Right. So what if the combination of all of the small contributions of food that people start making to this picnic potluck, right?
Or Ben, as you pointed out, some have more than others to contribute.
Sure. Yeah. And again, some may have not had any at all.
Hold on to it, right?
Yeah. So the combination of all of this that's happening as it's getting passed around is enough to feed everyone. And so much so that there's left over, right? There's more left over. I think of our Sunday family dinners when we have a potluck and everybody ends up bringing enough food to feed everybody. So we end up having like three or four times as much food, right? But like I was saying, I'm not looking for a less supernatural explanation of the story. What I was looking for is something that calls us to action. So what does that tell us? If it may have gone like this, what is this calling us to do? So Jesus isn't just providing for the people. He's calling us to provide as well. He's calling us to be part of that community, to give all we have, just like the boy gave all he had, whether it's a tiny bit or whether it's a lot, or maybe it's nothing. Maybe people that came had nothing. They just showed up and they were there. And because they were there, as Jesus says, any that come to me, I won't turn them away. Right? I won't send them away. I won't cast them out. They'll be part of what I'm doing. And just that very fact that they're there or they gave the little bit they had made it so that everyone was provided for.
Yeah, Ben, your reading brings to my mind the question, don't we, meaning if I take everyone as a whole, right? Don't we have everything we need? It's just that we're not sharing.
Right.
If we just shared, and if that's what Jesus can inspire us to do, then there will be enough to go around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ben, there's one other thing that I wanted to go into in this story, and that is from verses 2-3. I just thought it's one of those funny moments again where this is how it's translated by Rudin. A large crowd followed him because they were observing the signs he performed to heal debilitated people. But Jesus went away up the mountain and sat there with his students. So it's funny because it's one of those stories. I don't know that the King James is that different. I think there's one significant difference, which is verse 3 begins, and, whereas she has it, but. But the first thing I want to say is, it's just funny. It's one of those stories, again, where he's trying to get away from the people to be alone with his disciples, but they're following him. All these people are following him. And so again, disciples means his students, as Rudin translates, the people who are actually he's teaching. The other people are just these, the multitudes that we read about, right? Who are going to come to him to be healed and who are, again, following him. And again, in that verse earlier, maybe they weren't really there, but they have to be there later so they can be fed. And so they get added in. But the point is, there are all these people that he's really trying to get away from, but that are following him. But then when they do catch up with him or actually get ahead of him, he has compassion and he heals them. So the interesting thing about the second verse, that is verse 3 out of these two verses, is that if it begins and, it's a little bit different than if it begins but. I'll read it again. A large crowd followed him because they were observing the signs he performed to heal debilitated people. But Jesus went away up the mountain and sat there with his students. That's different from and, because you could get the sense that, okay, he dealt with them and then he went somewhere else. But if you read it but, then it says he didn't deal with them. He went and did something else. And the thing about the Greek is it actually says but. There's a secondary meaning to this word that's and, but it's first but. And there's another word for and. So why does it say de, right? Probably because it should be read but. But it's interesting because it produces two different stories. And it's kind of funny, you know, one more of these stories where Jesus is trying to get away from the people. And yet he blesses them, or he tells people, don't tell anybody. But then he tells some people, tell everybody. There's a lot of ambiguity here.
He's enigmatic.
Yeah. And then, of course, I'm not taking into account, even while I'm saying this, that I may be reading these things in different gospels. Remember that each gospel has a different author from a different time, from a different place, with a different audience and a different purpose. And here in John, we have a really different purpose because it's so late that now we're actually in conflict with the Jews, as he puts it, right? And that ends up causing, again, a lot of misfortune for Jews, right? Because the reading of this becomes anti-Semitic and causes all kinds of horrible things, all the way up to and including the Holocaust, right? Whereas John's probably just referring to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, or some people who are in charge, right? Some kind of authorities among the Jews, not the Jewish people as a whole.
That's right.
Ben, in John 6:19, we get in the KJV how far the boat was when Jesus is going to walk out to it, right, on the water. And it's in furlongs. So if you don't know what those are, then you just come over to Rudin and you find out they're states. And so, if you don't know what those are, then let's back up to the NRSV. In all fairness to Rudin, she tells us in her footnote how far that is, right, in today's terms. But the NRSV gives us 3 or 4 miles. So I don't know what kind of, I'm hearing hyperbole. I don't actually know how far across the lake is. It's not that big.
It's not that big, yeah.
It's not that big. But I'm not really good with miles, and so I don't know. I think that means it can't be 3 or 4 miles, you know, even if you're close to the other shore. But obviously, we're having this story about Jesus walking on water. This could be hyperbole to add to the, you know, the effect of that. So Ben, in verse 21 of John 6, we get a story that's a little bit different from the other two gospels in terms of, remember we said that Jesus was intending to walk past them, past the boat and his disciples in the boat? In John 6:21 in Rudin, we read, they wanted to take him onto the boat, but right away the boat got to the shore where they were heading. This means Jesus never got in the boat. He walked all the way across the lake in this version of the story.
Yeah. Well, in Rudin's translation, because in KJV, right, it says, then they willingly received him into the ship, implying that he did get into the boat, and immediately the ship was at the land where they went, meaning he got in the boat and then the boat arrived at the land. But Rudin is saying almost the complete opposite of this in her translation. She's saying he didn't get in the boat at all because the boat hit the shore as soon as Jesus came along.
Yeah. I'll give my best literal translation looking at the Greek. They were willing to receive him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the other side. So it's actually ambiguous.
Yes.
But it's more reasonable to say he didn't get in the boat, because if it's already at the other side, and it actually says they were willing to receive him into the boat, it doesn't say they did, right?
Yeah. So what do we learn theologically from this, Christopher? That's kind of a joke.
Then I'm just going to finish my sentence. Then it's reasonable to read this as he never got in the boat, right? So he actually walked all the way across. So he intended to walk past them and he didn't, but he also didn't get in the boat. Anything to add to that, Ben?
it's an interesting difference in the story, right? I'm just trying to understand, like, I'm trying to grasp, like, what that means, like, you know, whether this really indicates something different substantively about what's going on with Jesus and his relationship with his disciples. And I can't quite put my finger on it if there's anything.
So another detail here, Ben, is that in John 6:22, we get that nobody else walked on the water in this story because Jesus did walk past the boat.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't mention Peter. So
right. So it's a really different story. So what does that mean? Again, I don't know, right? Good question. I'll leave that to you and me and the listener to think about.
Next, we get this bread of life sermon, so-called, right? So Jesus seems to be having some debates a little bit with the Pharisees, but his audience is also those people that have been following him. And he's talking about the bread that he fed him with feeding the 5,000, and sort of chastising them, if that's the right word, for the fact that they didn't come to really listen to him and understand and follow him in the metaphorical sense, follow him as in do what he's teaching. They came to follow him around so they could get fed, right? Because they know that's where the food is. If they show up to the potlucks, they'll always get fed without having to bring anything, right? So he's kind of calling out the people who could contribute and are the freeloaders, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
So there's a statement here in verse 34 where the people say, "Sir, give us this bread," because he's talking about the bread that they will eat, that they will be filled, right, and never hunger again. This is an allusion back to the woman at the well, right? Remember when he's at the well talking with the woman and he says, "If you would ask me, I'd give you water and you would never thirst again." And she's like, "Sir, give me this water," right? It's basically the exact same statement, but bread instead of water.
That's interesting, Ben. Ben, you alluded earlier to this verse, John 6:37. "Whatever the Father grants me will reach me, and whoever comes to me, I won't throw out," as Reardon has it. And the "throw out" in King James Version reads what?
In King James Version, this is translated as "cast out."
Cast out. So the reason I wanted to pause on this verse, Ben, is just because it sounds like there's some, if we have Jesus not throwing or casting people out, then maybe that implies that he would throw or cast people out. And so I wanted to get your take on that verse, Ben, so that we don't misunderstand, you know, and think that Jesus would, in some case or another, if not this case, cast or throw people out.
Yeah, so I don't think Jesus is implying in any way that there are circumstances where he would. What he's actually doing here is this phrase, "cast out" or "throw out," seems to be referencing what the religious institutions of the time were doing to the people, right? So obviously you talked about this, Christopher. John says the Jews, but it's when it says the Jews, it's actually talking about the leadership, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes. And it was their responsibility to cast out anybody who was unclean or a sinner, something, things like that, right? Which is why they're always coming to him and say, "Hey, why are you eating with publicans and sinners, people that we've cast out from among us?" And Jesus says in this verse, "They're coming to me. And if people come to me and they'll follow me, I'm not going to turn them away. I'm not going to throw them out. I'm not going to cast them out like you do," right?
Yeah. So as I recall, there's actually a double negative in the Greek here. And so that supports your reading, Ben. And so what it gives us is, anyone who comes to me, I can take that double negative and turn it into a positive and say, I'll welcome them. I'm not turning anybody away. Anybody who comes to me, I welcome.
The sermon turns now into sort of an echo, and he's been moving in this direction for a while with the Bread of Life sermon, turns into an echo of the Exodus narrative. Remember, in Exodus, the people are fed by manna from heaven, which is what they start calling in the later generations looking back. It's the bread from heaven, even though at the time it wasn't really bread. In fact, the manna just means, what is this, right? It's just the whatchamacallit stuff. They don't know what it is, but it comes and they eat it. But it becomes referenced as the bread from heaven. So Jesus is saying, That's actually me. That was the metaphorical bread from heaven, the symbolic one. I'm the real thing. And so people at Moses' time, they were complaining about needing food, and Moses provides them with this manna from God. So, but he didn't really know where it came from. And the people that ate it, they're dead now. Jesus is saying, I know where I came from. I'm the bread that comes down from heaven. And if you eat of my bread or eat of me, he gets kind of literal here. And by literal, he means metaphorical, right. Which gets really strange. And if you eat of me, then you'll never die. So Jesus is setting himself up as not just the successor to Moses, but he's superseding Moses. Okay, this is going to start making the people, not just the people that are followers of him, but also the skeptics that are listening, going to make them upset. And so we have this symbolic eating of the flesh and drinking of the blood of Jesus that he seems to be preaching literally. And to many of the followers that are there listening, eating blood is forbidden in Jewish dietary laws. So this is offensive to them.
Ben, something you said really struck me. You said he makes it more literal, right? The eating of Jesus becomes more literal. And by literal, you mean metaphorical. And right. That just sums up a lot of John. If John doesn't make sense, that's why. And I think with that, if we can just underline that, right? Then that saves me going into a lot of verses here. We'll just leave it at that, right? It's just, and this is what John does, right? He takes metaphors and he pushes them into reality. He just wants to push the metaphor until it just doesn't hold anymore. And
until it breaks almost.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so that just keep that with you through the rest of this chapter.
Right. The idea of eating the flesh and the blood, or at least the flesh of a god, might have had cultural context in the time within the Greek hero cults. Within their rituals, there was talk of eating the god, right? That's right. They were worshiping. And so this concept may have been familiar to the people of time, but it would have been offensive on multiple levels because one, it's referencing like Greek practices, right? These heathens, right? And then the other is if you're advocating eating blood or drinking blood, then that is, again, like I said, that is a violation of the Jewish dietary laws. So all of this, you know, for those reasons, and then just like, you know, disgust, personal aversion, the people are very disgusted at what Jesus is saying to them. And then, like you said, Christopher, it's like he's saying, no, this is literally true. And then in the next verse, he says, and by literal, I mean metaphorical.
Right. Yeah. So reminding ourselves that we're under Roman rule, the context is Roman rule and Greek culture. So Roman rule doesn't mean Roman culture. This is Greek culture. This, we talked about this in our introduction to the New Testament, right? This whole part of the world has been Hellenized from Alexander the Great, right? From his conquests. So what we're looking at here is one of the texts that's parallel to this text, not just similar, but I'm going to say parallel because it's part of the context. And remember, Paul gives us, you can see that Paul knows his Greek philosophy and that when he's preaching to Greeks, you know, when he's preaching to Gentiles, where they only have the Greek culture, not the Jewish plus the overlaying Greek culture, right? He uses references that are clearly philosophical references from Greek philosophy. But here in John, there's another similarity that I picked up on. And when I just kind of stumbled on a monograph on this subject, which is this gospel looks a lot like the play of Euripides, the Bacchae. And so I was reading the Bacchae for the first time, and I thought, this is so strange. And the reason it's so strange is it's dealing with the mystery cults that we don't really know anything about, because mystery means you can't talk about it, whether because you're not allowed to, you're an initiate and you're not supposed to share with the uninitiated what you learned in your initiation, or, you know, you're dealing with something that can't be put into words. It's ineffable because you're talking about an experience that's of the divine, right? So I was reading the text and I thought, this is such a strange text, and yet it's so familiar. And I thought, how can that be? How can I think something is both strange and familiar? And the answer is because it reminded me of the Gospel of John. And I found, again, a monograph, so I'm not the only one who thought this. There's a scholarly monograph on this subject, on the similarities between the Gospel of John and the play The Bacchae by Euripides, which is a great play, by the way. Even if you aren't curious about, you know, comparing it with John, it's worth reading.
You know, I'd said earlier, Christopher, you know, Jesus says this is literal, and by literal, I mean symbolic. So that's here, verse 63. Jesus explains here that his teachings are spiritual and symbolic. And if the people are offended at the symbolism, they're going to miss the deeper message he's trying to convey to them.
That's right. We have some verses dealing with Judas betraying Jesus. I've pointed out in past episodes that the Greek reads that Judas hands him over, and there's a lot of handing Jesus over going on by people other than Judas. So it's hard to see why the translator is justified in saying that Judas betrays Jesus. And that's not what Sarah Rudin gives us. She just gives us handed him over, as it says in the Greek. So I think we'll probably deal with that more when we come to the alleged betrayal. Right, the handing over of Jesus. I know I can say that.
Yeah.
By Judas. And so we'll just deal with that then when we come to it. Then in John 6:66, we read, "Because of this," and this is Rudin, "many of his students turned back and no longer walked with him." So earlier they say, this is hard. This is rough talk, I think, is what Rudin wrote. Who can listen to this, right? And so they just, that's what you were dealing with, Ben, the idea that, what are you saying? That's just not culturally acceptable, right?
This does not abide by our community standards.
Right. And so people no longer walked with him. And then I think, okay, what about us? Right? So do we really understand what Jesus is asking of us? And if we did, would we still follow him? And I think, again, it's really easy to say, check, right? But I'm saying, no, really check yourself on this one.
Yeah.
And let's keep studying these texts and let's try to understand what Jesus is asking us to do and put aside our cultural ideas, especially as Americans. You know, we're podcasting from America to the world. I know we have listeners outside of America, but we have a lot of listeners in America. And our religion, right, as Latter-day Saints, is American in some sense. And we have to learn to distinguish between our nationalism and our Christianity. And by the way, we can go all the way back to the beginning where the story goes, Rome is Christianized. But I question that. My question is Rome Christianized or is Christianity Romanized? And then is it Americanized? And so if we peel back these layers, what do we find? That's the challenge I'm issuing.
So Jesus asks his disciples, are you going to go away too? Like he's kind of talking to his inner circle there, right? The implication is the 12. And here Peter, who's the foremost among them, seems to often speak up in these situations where Jesus asks a question. Peter seems to be the one where the answer is put in his mouth in multiple of the Gospels. So he responds and says, you know, where would we go? You have the words of eternal life.
Yeah.
So this is a statement of trust, right? This faith, trust from Peter. He is not saying he understands what Jesus is talking about. He's just saying he trusts him. He's had an experience that even though he cannot grasp rhetorically or logically what Jesus is talking about and why he's saying it this way, he trusts him enough to stick with it.
So another interesting thing here, a linguistic note, right? You have the words of life. You know, Master, to whom would we go? Translates Rudin. You have the words of life that last for all of time. And so she says in a note, in a footnote, that she reluctantly translates words here because the Greek is remata. We've talked a lot about the word especially in the Gospel of John, translating the Logos, right? The thing about the Logos is it translates word, sentence, paragraph, speech, rational principle. And we talked about the context in which this is said, again, the Greek culture and the Stoic concept of this organizing principle by which the divine creates and even maintains creation, right? There's almost like, I think in terms of Islamic theology, where God has not only created, but in every moment creates, right? It's a continuing thing. It's the Logos that holds it all together in Stoic thought and Allah in Islam, right? That's not what's going on here. This is Emata, which, Ben, what does that mean? I know you looked into this too.
Well, so that's just like the actual words, like not this removed abstract word that you're talking about, Logos, but the actual words or the news, right? The word on the street, so to speak, right? This is what's going on, the news.
Yeah, and so I thought that's worth pointing out, right? Usually when we're talking about the Logos in King James, you're getting a capital W word. But remember that, and John, again, he starts off, this was at the beginning of John, we covered this in John 1. He takes that idea of the Greek idea of Logos, and he says, he pushes that, right, as a metaphor, and he personifies it in Jesus, right? It becomes incarnate in Jesus. The word becomes flesh. I mean, those are the words he uses. And so in John 6:71, we get that in the King James, he spake of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, right? Because he says, one of them is going to betray you, right? For he it was that should betray him. And so that's coming from the verse before. It said that one of you is a devil.
Yeah.
The Greek actually says diabolos. So that really is, you know, that's where the word devil comes from. It comes from the Greek diabolos. But the question is, what is that? And it's really something like a slander. That's what we're talking about. So the idea here is, in our theology even, or at least in, I think, in the layman's understanding of it, I don't know, maybe even in scholarly understanding, but it just seems to me that we've conflated the serpent, the Satan, with a definite article, Satan as a proper noun with a capital S, the devil, this diabolos, right? All of these ideas, and we've talked about this all along, thankfully, right? So if you want to, you'd have to go back, right, and listen to every episode, because we're trying to look at, what does it actually say in the Greek, right? What are we dealing with? And of course, we go back to the Old Testament too. You and I, Ben, we talked about this in the Old Testament too. I think the idea is you have to look at the development of the idea of, I don't even know what to say, Satan, the devil, the serpent, right? All of this.
An adversary, yeah.
We're actually going to take that and put it on the Jews, right? It's not even Hasatan or whatever. It's the Jews are Satan. This leads to a lot of misfortune for the Jews at the hands of Christians, right? And John was doing something that I don't think he ever could have imagined would have led to something like the Holocaust, right? I would recommend to the listener a book called The Origin of Satan by Elaine Pagels. And that's one of many, by the way. This is something that the founder of Latter-day Peace Studies, Shiloh Logan, co-founder, with Lindsay Olin, actually looked into a lot of books on this subject. And so if you're curious, you know, beyond Elaine Pagel's book and you want a list, we've got it. Just reach out to us and we'll share it. All right. Well, that was a long chapter, John 6. So just a few chapters this week, but one of them was really long and convoluted. It's John after all, right? But I think, you know, we did it justice when we said it's metaphorical, by which I mean literal, by which I mean metaphorical.
Right.
Thanks for doing this with me, Ben, and thank you for listening. And thanks to all our volunteers at Latter-day Peace Studies. We have an all-volunteer team. Thank you for your donations, and thank you for your comments. Please like, subscribe, share, reach out to us, consider donating, volunteering, and thank you for listening.
Thank you, Christopher.